You're listening to the Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing You know what? I'm going to do it differently this time. You're listening to the Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living. They've since attained nirvana. Our question for episode 53 is something like, what philosophical insights can we glean from Buddhism? And we'll be speaking to Owen Flanagan, professor at Duke University in philosophy and neurobiology, about his 2011 book, The Bodhisattva's Brain, Buddhism Naturalized. For more information on this episode and discussion that you can participate in, please check out partiallyexaminedlife.com. My name is Mark Linsenmeyer in a state of transcendent bliss from Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin, craving sense pleasures in Austin, Texas.
This is Wes Allen, suffering in Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Dylan Casey, natural and realistic in Middleton, Wisconsin.
And we will add to Mr. Flanagan in just a few minutes. First, we wanted to just give a brief introduction. What is this book about?
Well, it was prompted by the fact that there was publicity to the effect that neuroscience was in the process of empirically verifying that Buddhism can make you happy. And Flanagan thought there was some hyperbole to that, and he had also had an interest in Buddhism because he had been invited to a discussion with the Dalai Lama and some other philosophers and scientists. Even though he's a naturalist and a fan of science and neuroscience, he had some reservations about whether the publicity was warranted. So the first part of the book really addresses that question of whether neuroscience can tell us whether Buddhism makes us happy and whether it can answer that type of question in general. And then, because one of the conclusions of the first part is that we really need a good idea of what we mean by happiness and what Buddhism is and all those sorts of things in order to make that evaluation, he spells out what he calls a naturalized Buddhism would look like in the second half. And by naturalized, he means something that gets rid of superstition and magical thinking. So, for instance, he's going to reject what he calls untamed versions of karma, rebirth and afterlife and luminous consciousness and things like that. He wants to sort of
nirvana. Yep.
Get it. Yeah. He wants to get at the philosophical core of Buddhism, which he takes to be a lot like Aristotle's conception of what it means to lead a good life and what it means to be happy. And that tradition is eudaimonistic. Eudaimonia is a Greek word that was once basically translated as happy. It's more often translated as flourishing now. That translation is meant to capture the fact that happiness here isn't just our colloquial conception of happiness as a subjective feeling of a good mood or something like that. It's about having something to do with psychological health, or as Aristotle elaborates it, virtue, excellence, an organism functioning as it should.
Great. And if you've tuned into this just to hear about Buddhism, we do talk about that eventually and talk about this book, but Flanagan is also a major figure in the philosophy of mind. So we talk about that a little bit at the beginning, try to draw him into some discussions from past podcasts, including the past one we did on Buddhism. That's episode 27 on Nagarjuna. Also, we did a recent one on Merleau-Ponty and some others on phenomenology. And he has got a section of this book on Buddhist phenomenology. So we talk to him about that a little bit and then get into sort of the meat of his book. You really get a good overall picture, I think, of what he's about as a philosopher and why he would be arguing for a naturalist position and what that means, etc.
Let's bring him in.
Hello.
Hey, we got it.
All right. You're on with the whole group here.
Fantastic. Do you guys keep your cameras on when you do this?
No, there are no cameras involved. Too much bandwidth.
Yeah, okay. So I'm going to turn my camera off here.
Since we can't see each other, pretty much we just interrupt each other a lot. And
I understand.
I have all the separate tracks and I can disambiguate them and take us from on top of each other. And then after all the tracks go together, we do a lot of editing. So don't worry about anything that might come out of your mouth.
Okay. I know that you're for adult listening only, according to your website.
Gets pretty racy.
Exactly. That's, yeah, absolutely fine. I trust you. You're the experts.
If folks have not heard of Mr. Flanagan, the thing that I had heard of him because of, and I guess was this your breakthrough book, Your Consciousness Reconsidered?
I guess that was, that was about my time of breaking in or breaking through, possibly, depending on how you view it. But early 90s, I did two books around that time, Varieties of Moral Personality and then Consciousness Reconsidered. And those are my, still what I think of in many ways, my best work.
Yes, but obviously you didn't keep to that particular philosophy of mind realm there. I'm not going to make you give the whole story of why you discovered Buddhism and things like that. We actually have already on the website posted links to not only one of your other podcast appearances, but to your lecture at the London School of Economics and Political Science.
Oh, good. Okay.
So folks listening, if you want the full background, if you want our monologue out of Mr. Flanagan, or can I call you OJ?
Call me Owen. You know, actually, what I did for my first teaching job was at a prep school in Massachusetts before I got a regular philosophy job for 2 years. And in those days, the students did call me OJ. And luckily, that sort of went away. So that was very much a good thing that stopped.
We did a Philosophy of Mind episode a couple of years ago now, where we read very brief excerpts of a lot of things, and it probably would have been good. I looked at your book a little during that time, but it would have been good to call on that a little more immediately to be kind of a peacemaker between the Mysterian Thomas Nagel and the almost behaviorist Dan Dennett position that we read.
Dan Dennett, exactly right. Now, that's what I thought of myself as doing in those days. I mean, I was always very interested, and this is a different version than I've told of any how I got into the Buddhism business. I just was always interested in this question about what people are like deep down inside beneath the clothes of culture. And I was very aware of how different theories of mind, I was always interested in the history of psychology, history of concepts of mind. And I was aware of the fact, even back when I was doing pretty straight philosophy of mind, that different people, different cultures, different traditions thought about personhood, the nature of the mind, the nature of the mind-body relation, the nature of reason and emotions connection very, very differently. So it isn't as if the interest in consciousness that I really basically started with wasn't coincidental with this broader interest in what some people call moral psychology. And in fact, the same year I published Consciousness Reconsidered, I did this other book called Varieties of Moral Personality, and the subtitle of that was Ethics and Psychological Realism. So these ideas have been, I've been learning new things, but the interests have been in some ways remarkably consistent.
I noticed you talk about phenomenology a lot, that was one of the things, right, that Dennett, for instance, should have paid more attention to first, which he's not actually, I'm not going to sidetrack the discussion. Right. Before we get
Let's talk about the Buddhism book.
All right, I'm ready to do that, guys. Go for it.
This is a connecting piece that you talk about phenomenology a lot in both this book and the older book.
Right.
But I don't see any references to the European tradition phenomenology. It's all William James and those folks, not so much Sartre and Merleau-Ponty and stuff. Is that, do you discard them? What is your take on that?
No. When I was in graduate school, I read a lot of Husserl, and I remember reading Merleau-Ponty, who I appreciated quite a bit. I didn't really felt like I got Husserl. And I knew that there was this phenomenological tradition, especially in Germany, but I just didn't feel comfortable and competent with respect to it. But my entry to psychology and my hero from the very beginning, actually, one reason I entitled that book Varieties of Moral Personality was echoing William James's Varieties of Religious Experience. Mm-hmm. And I just found that, and I still do now that I'm more of an expert on European phenomenology, I find the program of someone like William James actually much more congenial to the idea that there really are varieties of ways that experience seems to people of different types. I mean, so someone like Husserl was really looking for universal features of human experience. And one possibility, although James didn't go this far, is that that isn't exactly the right way to look at things. You might want to, first of all, just get the texture of the different ways that all kinds of different individuals, whether they be temperamentally different or from different cultural or religious contexts, experience their minds. So I was aware of the European tradition, but I try not to speak about whole traditions as opposed to find an author who I really know pretty well, who I think is exemplary of taking, in this case, experience seriously. And at least in the Anglo-American tradition, there's probably no one better than William James. So Dennett is tricky on this because he was very, very important in my own philosophical upbringing. When I was still in graduate school, he was in Boston in those days where I was, and he was a startlingly brilliant young philosopher of mine, still is, of course, but he's not young anymore. And I actually wrote my dissertation on the origins of Skinner's behaviorism in logical positivism. And I was talking to B.F. Skinner a lot at the time, but I was also studying with Quine at the time, and I was reading papers papers like Dennett's Intentional Stance, and I was quite aware of the fact that despite his tendencies towards behaviorism, he was no longer bound up by positivistic constraints on doing psychology. So I always actually just think of Dan Dennett as a really important, excellent philosopher who's not, he's certainly not a Mysterian, and this is where I have trouble with the Mysterians. And I don't even know if I would call Nagel, by the way, a Mysterian. I certainly think Colin McGinn, of course, is the one that I pick out. I call actually Nagel in that work a principled agnostic about solving the mind-body problem, not a Mysterian. A Mysterian, the way I defined it in those days, was that a Mysterian is someone who believes that you will never be able to solve. We humans are epistemically limited such that we will never, ever be able to solve the mind-body problem, or what Dave Chalmers ended up calling the hard problem of consciousness. A principled agnostic like Nagel and What It's Like to Be a Bat and other papers takes a position that he doesn't see for sure that we'll never be able to solve it, nor is he confident, as people like Dennett and I are in some moods, that it's just a matter of time before neuroscience solves the problem of consciousness. It may be in the same form that something like the problem of life was solved in 1957 by Watson and Crick, something like that.
Can I ask a kind of maybe stupid or naive question? Is what would it mean to say you solved that problem? I mean, and even the saying that the problem of life was solved in 1957 by Watson and Crick, that's also not altogether clear.
Right.
Saying that everything that's living is DNA isn't the same thing as saying what makes a living thing. Exactly. So I'm just wondering what the terms of solving that problem are.
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying. Well, you picked exactly up on what I was sort of sweeping under the rug. I said in the same way that we have a solution in 1957. Because the way that I think about it sometimes is that sometimes philosophical problems that seem insurmountable don't actually get solved in the deep way that philosophers sometimes ask for, namely, give me a solution that explains what consciousness is in any possible world that it exists in. I actually think that may be a kind of a question that we won't be able to answer. But I think about it this way. You might say this. Once upon a time, we'll say 14 billion years ago, there was the singularity that banged. And when the singularity banged, whatever it was made of was not organic. So at some time, that inorganic stuff, the stuff that could be explained by physics and chemistry, somehow or other gave rise to life. Now, we still don't actually have a complete and satisfactory explanation about how that occurred in the first place, how those unicellular organisms came to be. We also don't have the next explanation, which is an explanation about how living things, which were not sentient, supposing they weren't sentient, some people, of course, think that they were, but supposing that there was first non-life and life emerged, and then life existed but not sentience, but then life with sentience emerged, we don't have good historical explanations. We have something like, even in science, we have explanation sketches of how those things happen, right? And then with Watson and Crick, you're exactly right. You picked up on exactly the right point. That doesn't tell us. It tells us what material substances, life as we know it and are interested in it, supervenes on, and basically some of the mechanisms by how it's transformed and transcribed and transmitted. But I don't think that's completely irrelevant, because you might think about things like water is H2O. That's actually something which is, I ask my students, I say, how many of you have done the hydrolysis experiment that shows that water is H2O? And only usually two or three in a philosophy class have ever done the experiment in high school of separating out hydrogen and oxygen from the molecule. You shouldn't do it at home because it's dangerous and all that. But you could continue to be skeptical to this day about even the water H2O identification, because no one ever sees the wet potable stuff that we call water at the same time they see those atoms. I mean, they're not simultaneously sighted. They're just procedures in a web of theory. This is the influence of Quine. They're inference to the best explanation given an overall web of theory about how the thing works. And I think that's what my view about consciousness being solved. I make the distinction between there being a satisfactory explanation of consciousness and a satisfying explanation of consciousness. And I think the same way with the explanation of life, it's still not to this day entirely satisfactory. We don't have all the details, and we may never have all the details. And we certainly don't have even, some people say we don't have a clue about how consciousness emerges. But actually, there's some neuroscientific research which would say, well, insofar as we're studying the brain, we're studying conscious and unconscious processing, and we're getting closer and closer to the underlying mechanisms that explain all the different kinds of processing which take place. And I think that will someday, I think the problem will not so much be solved as kind of go away. That people will just start to say, oh, mental life occurs in the brain. That's the inference to the best explanation. And these structures are more important to its explanation than these other structures, say higher brain structures versus lower brain structures, something like that.
That's interesting, because in this book, you touch on this issue when you're talking about neurophysicalism and subjective realism.
Right.
And I thought you implied that whatever explanation there is, if it's to close the explanatory gap, it would have to go beyond correlation. It would have to say why a particular kind of neuronal activity leads to a particular feeling, let's say. Otherwise, you're stuck with epiphenomenalism.
Yeah, I think that this thing I call subjective realism, again, it's an inference to the best explanation. So it's very much, as it were, an empirical hypothesis. But the idea is something like this, that one thing I try to do, back to that earlier book, Consciousness Reconsidered, I had this idea that if you're going to study consciousness empirically, you've got to come at it from all the perspectives that we think are relevant. And the main perspectives that seemed relevant were obviously something like the psychological and the behavioral, but then the neuroscientific. You want to look at when people say things like, I'm having experience of a orange after image, you want to look at what parts of the brain are lighting up, because presumably that's going to be relevant. You want to look how it affects behavior. And you want people to say as much as they possibly can about the first-person phenomenological feel of the experience. So I call that the natural method. And the idea was that these are three different perspectives to look at a phenomenon that, again, as an inference to the best explanation, we think takes place mostly in the body. So the idea of the subjective realism or the neurophysicalism that I talk about is just operating with the assumption that we are material beings living in a material world, and that we're 100% animal. This is what I call, you know, taking the message of Darwin seriously. And that we have no special parts that are non-physical, a la Descartes or most other traditions. That's sort of the background assumptions. I don't, in this work or in most of my recent work, give arguments for why you should assume physicalism. Mm-hmm. It seems obvious to me that it's the best bet. And what that provides you with, though, is a way of explaining why people have these powerful intuitions that we can't close the explanatory gap. It's that there are three perspectives that we can take actually on the human mind: first personal, third personal, and some people nowadays talk about the second personal.
Do you find any practical upshot, given that you pay so much attention to phenomenology, to, say, Merleau-Ponty makes this argument we talked about in a recent episode, that these naturalistic presuppositions that you're talking about have to grow out of the phenomenology itself, that our basic starting point in philosophy is something like where Descartes started. Mm-hmm. And so we can describe the field of phenomena, and then abstracted from that are all the things that go to make up natural science. And for Merleau-Ponty and Sartre and the rest of those folks, this had some fairly powerful practical upshot. Yes, you can still do science and all that, but there's some part of our experience that you might say is more primary than science, right, than this naturalism. And this maybe is what is fueling what some might think as you in your work oppose naturalism to supernaturalism, right?
Right.
As opposed to philosophical non-naturalism, something
yeah,
like
right.
what G.E. Moore, when he argues that good is not a natural property in the world because we can't reduce it to something about physical objects or really any about pleasure or anything like that. It has to be something sui generis that shows up in experience. And this is exactly the kind of thing that you see in Sartre and these other folks.
Right. No, it's very helpful what you just said. So I'm not entirely seeing how exactly the G.E. Moore goes with the Merleau-Ponty Sartre, but you sound like you're more up on the that than I am. But I'll say something about that. Okay. So there is this idea, you're right, in some of the French and German phenomenologists, and they do seem relevantly different in different books. I mean, I remember reading Merleau-Ponty's Phenomenology of Perception and also his The Structure of Behavior. And I thought both were just brilliant works where he knew a lot about empirical psychology.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike, it seems to me, Edmund Husserl or even Jean-Paul Sartre. So there's one meaning, right, of phenomenology that means to start with the appearances wherever they may sit. And of course, in Husserl, there's this idea that one starts by suspending the natural attitude. That is, stops by, for example, being committed to something that G.E. Moore in another mood would say everybody's committed to, namely belief that there is an external world. So you have to suspend the natural standpoint and do really thick description of the way appearances seem across a lot of domains. You might say on one reading of that phenomenological tradition, it means you should always take the experiential as having not only genetic priority in the sense of it comes first, of course it comes first, but also some kind of methodological priority for what the philosophical method is or what philosophers ought to believe in. I don't buy that. And the reason might be, this could be a story about my own philosophical training. I mean, I was really raised by Quine and Quinians to believe that the best philosophy is continuous with science. So although exactly what you just were pointing to is at stake in some of the contemporary debates. So, for example, some people will say things like, as if it's evidence, when I examine my own experience, it doesn't seem as if it has any neural texture to it. Now, I just take that as a datum about the way experience seems, but I don't take it seriously as a datum about how experience is realized. That is, I take it seriously that, again, the inference to the best explanation nowadays is that experiences just are physical events in brains, even though they don't reveal themselves that way.
Is that any different than something like saying, when I'm growing up, I don't really feel like I have any DNA?
Yep. It's the same. Now, no one would presumably want to make an inference about what their body contained of chromosomes and in the cells and how the cells reproduce based on introspection. No one would ever think it was authoritative to say, I'm not aware of any E. coli in my stomach, therefore I don't have any E. coli in my stomach. Or I'm not aware of the number of E. coli in my stomach, therefore there is no number of E. coli in my stomach. So I think this is at some level, I mean, obviously no phenomenologist would have to take, and this is where phenomenology, in ways that I don't completely understand myself, will claim that they differ from introspectionist. You might say, well, obviously you can't introspect certain things about your embodied being. So the question is, I mean, I remember when I wrote Consciousness Reconsidered, people would ask me, okay, suppose you have neuroscientific data, psychological data, and experiential data. What do you do when they conflict, which is Trump? I take it from what you just said about Merleau-Ponty and maybe Sartre and Husserl, that their move would be when push comes to shove, the experiential will trump. My usual view is wait and see, depends on the case, which is Trump. There's no general answer to the question, which is Trump. But if you wanted to have a theory about the mind in the natural world, watch seriously what your science is saying and use that as part of the data source.
It strikes me that there's sort of... It depends a little bit upon what you're trying to embrace with your explanation.
Right.
For instance, the role of experience is going to be different than a causal explanation.
Okay.
Just in a simple way, the way a baseball player understands the way they hit the ball might have nothing at all to do with the way it actually happens from, a physics standpoint, and the way that's perfectly articulable and maybe even understandable from the standpoint of me looking at the ball and saying, well, the bat has a certain amount of mass and the ball's coming in with a certain speed and there's this angle relation. And based upon that, I can tell you how far he's going to hit that ball every single time. Mm-hmm. And his experience, his way of understanding that activity is not going to be like that generally.
That's right.
And it doesn't seem to me that it's even a question of trumping. It has a question of the way in which experience is working in our consciousness. And the thing that might apply to this sort of trumping business would be the way in which experience feeds on itself as being not a material thing, but being part of the larger activity that it speaks to itself in higher orders that matter. I mean, that for instance, in kind of a straightforward, that my idea about something might affect the way I think about something else.
That's right. So two things you said, I think, are exactly right. I mean, I'm a big believer in the importance of really good phenomenology. And this is why I love, say, in my case, William James so much. And when I did read Merleau-Ponty and Sartre on the gaze, I mean, these are like unbelievable moments. Or David Foster Wallace about the phenomenology of addiction. There's no better descriptions about the way things seem than some of this kind of writing. But I think you put your finger on the topic. It's one thing to take phenomenology as authoritative for describing the way experience seems, but not as explanatory about what there is or what it supervenes on or what the causal laws are that are governing it. I think that's exactly right. Now, you could even make a further distinction just using this language of the way experience seems as opposed to the way I understand it. I mean, it's an interesting question, and both introspectionist psychologists and phenomenologists were all on about this. You want, on the one hand, virgins when it comes to describing experience, like people who aren't used to like articulating all the time, because they may be going way too meta and theorizing about the way their experiences are. I mean, imagine the baseball player who just knows so much about baseball that he incorporates a lot of theory into his description about how things seem. Now, it's possible, of course, that his theories about what he's doing when he swings at a curveball as opposed to a changeup, as opposed to a fastball, are actually the way it seems to him intuitively. There are also possibilities that they're not aligned. But I think you're right, that the role of phenomenology typically is best at describing and taxonomizing the way mental states seem to individuals. And for that, it's the only show in town at this point. For, again, good evolutionary reasons, we have good first personal access to our own experiences at certain levels or experiences of certain kinds. And not paying attention to that during the heyday of behaviorism was a problem. And thankfully, in the early 90s, when Dennett and Searle and I and a lot of other people started to talk again in the Anglo-American tradition about the inner, that was welcome because you obviously can't leave it out.
This seems like a good transition to... You basically say in this book that the Buddhists, if they didn't invent phenomenology, at least the first systematic phenomenological text that we have access to.
Right.
So you talked about the Abhidhamma or Abhidharma, depending on what language you're taking this from.
Right, exactly.
I spent a little time looking at this because you can find text of this online. Of course, it's kind of hard to figure out exactly which part to look at or
exactly
their secondary
right.
sources from hundreds of years later that sum it up that are just as difficult as the primary. I thought I'd just read a paragraph of this just to give folks a flavor of what this sounds like, because I found it nearly impenetrable, certainly extremely redundant, internally redundant.
Yep.
And it just made me question, like, well, what is phenomenology in the first place? It's a systematic description of experience, but really we see a lot of lists in here. So,
exactly.
So it starts out the whole thing. Chapter 1, the 8 main types of thought relating to the sensuous universe. Which are the states that are good? When a good thought concerning the sensuous universe has arisen, which is accompanied by happiness and associated with knowledge, and has its object a sight, a sound, a smell, a taste, a touch, a mental state, or whatnot, then there is contact, feeling, perception, thinking, and then they give 50 more things.
Right. Yeah.
Now these, or whatever other incorporeal, causally induced states there are on that occasion, these are states that are good. And then there's a section after for each of these things that defines it. I'll just read the first one. What on that occasion is contact, which it says that's a translation of faso in the Pali. The contact, which on that occasion is touching, the being brought into contact, the state of having been brought into touch with. This is the contact that there then is. So,
got it. Right.
And then there's a million more definitions just like that, that either seem totally uninformative or I had a really hard time figuring out how to take this. But you seem to come away from this having gained quite a bit.
Well, yes and no. Just like any taxonomy can be, it can be kind of boring. But think about it this way. Let's try this. So you might say, if you want to do, let's forget about what phenomenology attaches to, whether it's about your incorporeal soul or mind or about your brain or and your experience. This book, or these books, as you say, I mean, one of the things that actually makes Buddhism or the Buddhisms impossibly difficult is that there are, as you say, the original texts, which are not, of course, dictated by God. These are compiled by wise people, and then there are commentators. So there's no end to the tradition. There's no Pope in Rome who dictates for Buddhists what you're supposed to believe. There's no end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament. There's no Quran. There's none of these things.
Lots of things to chant, though.
A lot of things to chant. It depends on whether they're chanters or not, and that varies from place to place. But one of the things when I've been among friends in, especially Tibetan Buddhist friends, they will say that the amazing thing about Buddhism compared to Western science is that Western science is good at taxonomizing behaviors. It's good at analyzing specific body parts which do certain things, whether it be in anatomy or medicine or whatever, but that we're pathetic at having any tradition which certifies as legitimate the activity of, again, what we might call phenomenology. And they claim that they've been doing it for 2,500 years. And if you go to the more interesting parts of the Abhidhamma than you found, maybe, some of these lists can be interpreted this way. You might ask yourself this. How many mental states are there does a person have? Now, you start this way. We do this actually in the West a little bit. So In 1871 and 72, Darwin wrote the book, The Expression of Emotions in Man and Animals. Mm-hmm. And this is a really, really important book, and I think you'll see how it connects up. So Darwin had this idea that there were some universal facial expressions. And the book is filled with pictures of London actors on the stage and also of canines. And then a lot of speculation about what emotions might be universal across the world. He was asking his colonialist friends for information, like, do you see people always nodding for yes and shaking their head for no? Do you see the same face as the angry face that we see on the London stage in Papua New Guinea or in sub-Saharan Africa? So Darwin was looking for behavioral markers. Now, there's an interesting sort of history of science story here where Margaret Mead had a student, Paul Ekman, and she gave Paul Ekman the exercise of going off and doing his doctoral dissertation, disproving Darwin and showing that there were, in fact, no universal facial expressions. Notice so far, this is completely behavioral, right? Mm-hmm. They're looking for behavioral expressions. If you look in the Abhidhamma or the Abhidhammas, they're already 2,500 years ago exploring the inner texture of the way emotions seem to the owner of it. And they're taxonomizing them in terms of negative and positive emotional feeling states. Sometimes these are called afflictions, sometimes they're called wholesome and unwholesome, where they're being defined in terms of their affective feel. So eventually, in that Western story, what happens is that Paul Ekman goes off, he goes around the world and he goes to places like Papua New Guinea, and he finds out that there are, in fact, six, or now he's up to seven, faces which he thinks are culturally universal, which come with the equipment. And what then Ekman does, by the early 70s, he and his colleagues are publishing articles in Science magazine showing that there are behavioral measures on galvanic skin responses, on blood pressure, on heart rates, and so on and so forth, that are attached to the following emotions: fear, anger, happy, sad, surprise, disgust, and now he has contempt. Those faces, he claims, are absolutely universal. They show up in the facial musculature as measured by dental x-rays the exact same way, etc. What's interesting about this story, supposing it's true, there's pretty good evidence, I think, at this point that it's true, is that there's nothing said in our tradition about what it feels like. It's sort of a Thomas Nagel point. Mm-hmm. What it feels like to be angry, what it feels like to be surprised, what it feels like to be sad. There's no textured, thick phenomenological descriptions of these states in our tradition. So I think one of the reasons that I respectfully went to the Abhidhamma and maybe saw more there is that I was around so many Tibetan Buddhists who were bragging all the time about how they might not be good at telling you what the face does when a person goes into a certain emotional state, but they have much more thickly textured accounts of what it seems like to the person himself. The other thing that I think the Abhidhamma is supposed to do in all these taxonomies, and there is a lot of biblical work like this. I don't want to say that we don't see this in the Old and the New Testaments. I mean, for example, I talk about the six main mental afflictions. So these are things which Buddhists say are states of mind, which whether or not you behave according to them or not, these are almost always bad. So attachment or craving, anger, pridefulness, ignorance, delusion, afflictive doubt, things like this. So what the Abhidhamma is trying to present us with is what I call a simultaneous normative and descriptive taxonomy of the mental states, which I think in the Husserlian sense are pretty universal. So at this point, within Buddhism, there's a claim that everybody has the capacity to go into these states. And if you go into them, there's some of these states which are good, and their being good, or what they call wholesome, depends not only on the way the state feels, but also on its object. So if you're happy that you just murdered the bad guy, the happiness part is good, but that you just murdered the bad guy is maybe not a content. What Brentano, Husserl's teacher, and Freud's teacher, would have said, the content makes a difference there. So there's subtle taxonomy of the state of mind, being happy that you finished your yard work, that's wholesome, and being happy that you got revenge on your enemy, that would be unwholesome. Not because of the attitude state, but the content of the state. So there's an attempt to actually do a kind of a moral psychology in this way. And that's why I appreciate the book and give it its sort of kudos for doing these taxonomies in a way that reveals also the values of the Buddhist tradition.
So if we're going to judge whether that phenomenology is transferable to other cultures, it seems like we have to figure out whether those value claims that are built into the descriptions,
yep,
are a matter of injecting a theory that comes from their culture, or they're more or less given as part of the experience. That's exactly what I was talking about as phenomenological ethics and G.E. Moore and folks like that, that just see values. We have values in our experience. And in some ways, this is the only, you know, I've discussed this in terms of Hume and other folks, Adam Smith, that I think this is the only way that we could ground on ethics at all is by looking at our experience and then being circumspect about it and seeing how we could be wrong and how we could, you know, get more intelligent moral theories out of these basic, but still the basic values are right, have to be right there.
So it sounds like you are a Moorean in this sense. I'm getting more like what you think about this now. I don't think of Moore as a phenomenologist as much as I think of G.E. Moore as having this, there are a bunch of these contemporary intuitionists, moral realist intuitionists in ethics now. Famously, right, Moore has two moves in Principia Ethica. One is to say you can't define good in terms of natural properties. Mm-hmm. That's not going to bother any kind of modern day naturalist because we don't worry about definitions of things or analytic definitions and things like that. On my view, it's enough that goodness isn't part of some kind of spooky supernaturalistic world.
Right.
Okay. But the problem that Moore has is that he thinks that people of a certain refined sensibility, namely him and his other friends in Bloomsbury, they have special access to the good and the true and the beautiful. And that's always been the hardest thing to work out, what it could be about experiences that aren't acculturated experiences that would allow you to detect good as such, as opposed to good in what you were just, I think, said a minute ago, would be good as informed or interpreted by a certain kind of theory. Now, you see, it's okay with me if Buddhism or G.E. Moore have a conception of the good life that's informed or infused by a certain theory, as long as you could say plausible things about the theory. And that would be very complicated. Can I give an example that the Dalai Lama gave to me once? So I was over, I think you know this, I was there in 2000 for these meetings on destructive emotions. I think it's a good example of where you'll see, I'm on the side of admitting that Buddhism doesn't have a theory-neutral experiential view of wholesomeness, unwholesomeness, and so on. It became clear at these meetings that I was at that Buddhists thought that anger is by far the most destructive emotion. Now, when I was there, two things became clear, and actually Paul Ekman was at these meetings with me. Paul was incredulous because it sounded to him, even after the first day of our week-long meetings, that the Dalai Lama and his team thought that you could control not just the behavioral outcomes of going into certain emotional states. Like, imagine that you, the courageous guy who's, we know this from Aristotle, right? You're scared of going into battle, but you go into battle nonetheless. It sounded to us like the Dalai Lama thought that you could actually completely do away with the fear or the anger as natural responses to events. Like not just control the behavior in relation to them, but actually eliminate anger. So I brought up the example. I said, well, in the West, we have this idea that if you were to find yourself in a movie theater sitting next to Adolf Hitler before he had perpetuated the Holocaust, we think it would be appropriate to be very angry at him. And in fact, if you had a weapon, to kill him. And the Dalai Lama then consulted with these high lamas sitting behind him in Tibetan. And they turned back to the group and he said to me, we think that you should kill Hitler. And we think you should do it with a word in Tibetan that would be translated as you should do so with furious rage. And he kind of swung his arm as if he had a sword in it and was decapitating Hitler. But you shouldn't be angry. So this blew me away.
I actually kind of get that difference because I feel like I do that with my kids.
There you go.
you cut off their
quick
heads.
Stop the behavior.
Yeah. Well,
a quick stopping of the behavior, but then it's gone. There's no lingering.
Well, it's an interesting concept because on the one hand, we do have a theory. I don't think we have anything about our experience that tells us something similar to their views about destructiveness of anger. I think, at least where I come from, we have views that it's good to express your anger sometimes. In our sort of post-Freudian culture, you know, you don't want to keep all those things in. But here's a whole different tradition. And there's nothing about our experience, the experience of anger or righteous indignation or whatever, that tells us when it's right or wrong until we build theories. And I think we do have theories about these things. So we think that anger can poison the soul of the person who has it, as well as the relations between the parties, right? But we don't have anything as extreme as this view that it's always bad. It's actually always and everywhere bad. And his idea is sort of associated with a kind of an ethic where you take the action that's necessary, but the economy of your own emotions is something that you should have had training in self-cultivation and control and modification. Now, in this tradition, experience doesn't tell you that, at least not phenomenological study of experience doesn't tell you that. It's something about experience in the world tells you that holding on to anger, harboring anger is a bad thing. Eliminating bad guys is a good thing, but you shouldn't relish it because that'll poison your soul. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very complicated, culturally embedded theory. And I think we could talk about the merits of that, but we wouldn't end up talking in terms of phenomenology beyond a certain point, I don't think.
This makes me want to bring up the Iliad, the beginning of the book, The Rage of Achilles. And it makes me wonder if it's actually a very deep-seated difference, at least between Buddhist and Western cultures, of the role of anger. And in fact, it being not something merely to be sublimated, but actually something to be embraced and in fact part of our notion of honor.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point. Although, you know, some people, of course, read our Iliad. There's that old book by Julian Jaynes called The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. And in that book, he basically acts like when Homer and Virgil, the ancients were writing, they were just writing about sort of robotic creatures that had no inner life at all, but they were just developing sort of consciousness as we know it. That seems highly, highly implausible. So I totally agree that we prize a certain kind of, like you said, honor. And it was, to me, an interesting question and still is. I mean, the more I thought about whether this is a difference that makes a difference or not, I then was thinking a lot about Asian traditions like samurai culture. There's a long tradition in Confucianism about mercenaries who fight for the weak guy and kill the invaders. There's a tradition within the sort of martial art side of Asian philosophy. And the Tibetan people, the Bon people, were very warlike. So I was wondering whether or not this part of what the Dalai Lama was saying was unique to Tibetan Buddhism, and that the flair for the decapitation or the killing isn't in some ways sort of Achilles-like. I don't really know. One difference, though, is this. In the West, and this has to do with Buddhist metaphysics, it seemed to me upon reflection that one of the reasons that we think it's appropriate to be righteously angry towards Hitler or Stalin is because we think we have a strong traditional ideas about free will and Hitler's own agency. And Buddhists tend not to have those kind of views. So I would say that most traditional Buddhists would think of Hitler is a bad node in a complicated unfolding of the overall universe, and he didn't choose to be that way himself. So the language of choice and free will and stuff like that would make less warranted personal anger at a bad guy.
Now, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's often seen as a cutting point of where phenomenology and naturalist explanations differ, that phenomenologically, look at Sartre, I'm totally free.
Right.
And that's just a different level of explanation. That's not supposed to conflict with determinism as a matter of natural science and causality on that range. It's just that the notion of causality is confined to this kind of explanation in this scientific enterprise that we've created, that we've sort of carved out of experience, and the feeling of freedom is carved out of a different part. And yet, here we have Buddhists ostensibly doing some kind of phenomenology, but they actually apparently perceive this determinedness of their own choices, their own actions, at least so they didn't develop the same sort of vocabulary about talking about it that we have.
Right. Okay. So this is helpful. This is advancing the conversation in helpful ways for at least my thinking. So the first thing I'd say actually is that I'm not, you know, we'd have to have texts in front of us from the European phenomenologists. I mean, I like the way you just put it. Imagine that someone like Sartre was just putting forward the claim that from the point of view of experience, like of the young man who's got to decide between going with the resistance or taking care of his mom, right? He feels two very, very powerful, considered obligations. These are not arbitrary. They're both deep feelings of obligation he has, but he can only do one and not the other. So the Sartrean says that there is the overwhelming, you know, experience of being thrown and having these radical choices sometimes. That seems entirely fair that there is such experience like that in our life. And your suggestion is something like that for Sartre, that just stands as a fact about experience. It doesn't stand as a fact about reality, anything deeper than what my experience seems?
Well, I don't know if the cut is between experience and reality. I mean, the cut is the same place that Kant put it, basically, that you have the science, which is maybe you don't even say that's for certainly for Kant, that's not reality, but it is its own realm of objective meaning the things that you're describing are stable and you can go back to them and measure them again and again,
right.
You know, whatever they may have, a relation they may have to ultimate reality, whatever. But that's just a different than, you know, you got Kant's view of freedom, which is a different way of getting at, you know, it's all through experience, but it's a different realm within experience, however you want to put it.
Yeah, I get it. I think this is like the problem, I guess, that I'm so deeply interested in, what Wilfred Sellers calls the conflict between the scientific and the manifest image. And the way he runs it, this is an idea that he's getting from Kant. So I'm with you 100%. I mean, so when Sellers tells the story, right, the question is this. He says, okay, so we have these ideas, and I call it the humanistic image. We have this idea that humans are not 100% animal. And like, I don't seem to myself like the animals or the other animals. I seem to myself as a free agent. And then the scientific image comes along and it says, well, maybe you seem that way to yourself. We'll get back to Buddhism on this because it's not clear it seems that way to them.
Mm-hmm.
And you seem that way to yourself, but guess what? You are 100% animal and your behavior is governed by, let's suppose the position is deterministic laws. I'm not advocating that at this point, but there's this wonderful story that Arthur Eddington tells. I walk into this room, this philosopher's room, and I see before me my old philosopher's table. Well, actually, now there are two tables in the room. One is the table that I'm familiar with, the ordinary table of common sense, that's crunched together atoms, say, or it's a solid object. He said the other table is a more recent acquaintance. It's 80 to 90% empty space. And then he asks himself, can I combine these two and hold them both in my head at once? Or must I accept, and this is the Trump question, right, that we've been talking about, must I accept that the way the table seems to common sense is just the way it seems to common sense, and the way it really is the way described by elementary particle physics? Now, I take it that's exactly the same kind of issue that we have with the question of how experience seems when we look like we're making claims about the nature of things. So here's an example from our tradition. So William James, after he wrote the two volumes of The Principles of Psychology, wrote a short version of it called Psychology, the Briefer Course. And at the end of that book, in the epilogue, he says this, I've just told you everything there is to know about empirical psychology circa 1890. And he says, what is there? There's a little gossip, a little chit-chat, but no laws as firm as F equals MA. And he said, and furthermore, speaking in a Kantian mode, he says, psychology assumes that we're determined. It's a methodological assumption that she must make. But as a philosopher, I make the opposite assumption that we have free will. And he said, and now I leave psychology and go forward with that assumption. And he says, someday, maybe the Supreme Court of Metaphysics can resolve the issue about which is true. You might say, well, what's going on there? You could say, well, he's just saying that we have to be committed. I mean, the world is sort of Kantian. It depends on what domain. It's like Stephen Jay Gould on the way science and religion don't conflict. You could take that. It just seems to me kind of obvious that they do conflict if, as soon as the experiential claim is anything more than this is the way it seems to me, that my experience seems free. You could say that, but then the scientist can say, but here's the question that we ask. Are you free? And then when the scientist comes back and says, despite all the ways it seems to you, the evidence is that you're not. That seems to me the place that we often get into in this conflict between the manifest and the scientific image. I don't see how far phenomenology by itself can get you without a sort of a theory. Using the examples we were just giving, when someone like the Dalai Lama says, look, you shouldn't relish. P.F. Strawson had these the reactive attitudes. He says these naturally come with the equipment. So you might say, well, the desire to get revenge when a person has done you wrong is natural. And you might even suggest that it's universally so and that any humans that you come upon will feel that way. And maybe it even is. But I think what the Buddhists do is they say it's part of our metaphysics that everything in the world is dependent on everything else causally.
Mm-hmm.
And thus, that there's no place in the unfolding of things where an individual actually could get leverage over his or her own self such that she would be, as Galen Strawson puts it, ultimately responsible for her actions. So that, again, the view of any person, it's kind of paradoxical because on the one hand, Buddhists love to encourage changing yourself, self-transformation, and so on. But on the other hand, there is this view that things are going exactly the way they must go. There was a book that I came across about 5 or 6 years ago about the Buddhist reception in Europe in the 19th century by people like Nietzsche and Schopenhauer and so on. And they loved it because they thought this is so deterministic, so fatalistic, so nihilistic, and they appreciated it in their sort of depressive doldrums that they were in. There is that element that there's no conception of libertarian free will that I can find in the tradition anywhere.
But there is, if you see universal causality as a theory that's projected on it, at least in the progress of the tradition. We did an episode specifically on Nagarjuna a while ago.
Right.
And the addition of his whole school, the Madhyamaka school, to the traditional Buddhist doctrines of impermanence and no self is this emptiness,
right,
which is to contemplate everything and think about, does it have an inner being, and sort of try to break it down to its constituent parts. And I think a lot of this is using a phenomenological method and to say no. And part of that, the analysis of causality looks very much like Hume's analysis of causality, that you see one thing apparently causing another. Well, what does that connection consist of? I don't see that. Pretty much there's nothing to support ultimately, even the claim that everything is causal, even though that's a better claim and it sort of works conventionally better than the alternative. So it's not proposing some radical indeterminacy, but to say all of this is somehow empty.
Right. I think I agree with what you just said about Nagarjuna. There was this tendency in the metaphysics of Theravadin Buddhism and even in early Mahayana Buddhism that things were decomposable into simple. Like you might imagine, like Greek atomism would be something like a theory that things were composable into literally unsplittables, which were the atoms. And of course, now we found out that the atoms are splittable. There's protons and electrons, and maybe there are bosons and fermions, and God knows what else there is. And maybe it's turtles all the way down. That's very much a kind of a similar move to the way this move about emptiness was made, so that the idea is that there's no bottom to the unsplittability. And that was I think you could think about this in terms of our faculty psychology. Theravadins would divide, there'd be consciousness and say the five senses, and the five senses are where things bottom out. But of course, the five senses, even on our physicalistic deconstructions, would bottom out in further neuronal activity, and they'll go down to the atomic and the subatomic levels. But I still don't see in later Buddhism, in emptiness, anything like an introduction of causal powers of agents at all. If anything, the emptiness doctrine is thought to make the no-self doctrine even more devastatingly nihilistic or eliminativist or something like that. And I, by the way, agree. I think that there is a lot of similarity. I mean, I emphasize this in the book, between these Buddhist views and people like Locke and Hume onto Parfit and people like this about the nature of self and of all things in the universe being decomposable ad infinitum somehow. And the use of the concept of codependent or dependent origination is not causal talk. It's interesting, like you're saying. It's just that you see these patterns unfolding all the time. You could treat it as Humean sort of skepticism. I agree with that.
There's a part of your book in chapter 5 on being no self and being nice, where you're talking about emptiness and you have this phrase, if emptiness just means that no thing has intrinsic existence, is self-originating and so on. And you go on to talk about this idea of self-originating and emptiness. When I was reading that part, it struck me that the piece that's hanging out there is essentially emergence and higher order organization of things that is embedded, that is, it depends upon the things below it, but it's not wholly constituted of it. And this, there's even a strong and developing arena in science. Paul Anderson has a nice article about this back even from the 70s on how the arrangement of an ammonia atom isn't really determined by the lower level structure. A water atom, H2O, is different than, is something added to it than just two H's and an O.
Right.
And that, much less the behavior of water, either as we experience it or as we measure it. It's not just even a question of mere complication. The argument would go that there's a development of new kinds of interactions that the substance is subject to. I was wondering in this aspect about the way in which emptiness relies on the notion of self-originating. I mean, that would be the way out of nihilism, right?
I see the way you want to go on the, I mean, my experience, and of course, you know, the trouble with trying to figure out the Buddhist view on this is that the Pali Canon alone is 14 times the size of the Bible, and that's without the commentaries. So I'm sure there's good Buddhist literature on this emergence idea, but you tell me, I mean, I thought that the idea of emptiness, the orthodox idea of emptiness in Nyingma, had to do with the fact that actually what we would call the emergent levels, in other words, I'm happy with emergence, like that my mind is an emergent property of the very complicated activity of my nervous system, etc., and it's not reducible to it. But I thought that this view was that from the ultimate point of view, I'm making a mistake. There is really no such thing as my mind. From the conventional, or the self, from the conventional point of view, it's perfectly appropriate to talk that way, just like it's perfectly appropriate to talk about tables and chairs for Eddington. But there really are no tables and chairs in the ordinary sense of tables and chairs. Since I'm not a Buddhist, and I'm not completely on their side about all these metaphysical issues, I mean, this is an ancient tradition, I like the fact that it's sort of, as I say, a Heraclitean view. It has this aspect of thinking that wholes are made of parts in complex relations. So, for example, there's a good philosopher, Mark Sideritz. I think he and Jay Garfield are the two best, well, a guy named Charles Goodman too, the three best philosophers studying Buddhism. And Mark Sideritz thinks that Buddhist reductionism is committed to that there's no emergence, emptiness just goes all the way down, and that things like selves and minds and consciousnesses are actually some form of illusions. So that's a fairly strong view. On the other hand, there's got to be pushback, and I think what you're trying to do that's nice is to allow for a world in which there are all these very, very complicated part-whole relations, which seems like something that we've done better jobs in the West of figuring out than at least I know of in Buddhism, how that works. But you're right. That would be the way around the reductive and nihilistic view.
Right. Maybe that even if Buddhists are doing phenomenology, they don't call it that, and they don't have some of the ontological assumptions or findings that came up with some of the more modern versions of that.
That's right.
That the whole point of the Merleau-Ponty view that I was trying to sketch out a little was that we can't say that the things of science or the decompositions that science leads us to are ontologically basic, that our ontology ultimately comes out of this description of experience. So to put that in Buddhist terms, what we would say is conventional reality. If what that means is what I'm, you know, I think that I can describe myself as a transcendent object, as Sartre would describe it. In other words, I have a personality that persists over times. I have virtues, all this kind of stuff. Now, to the Buddhist, that's just conventional reality.
Right. That's right.
And ultimate reality will get rid of that. So they don't accord that any place in their ontology, but there's nothing to stop us from saying, you know, obviously they have to acknowledge, as you've made the point in your book, that conventional reality is important for a lot of things. It's important for doing ethics. You don't have any ethics
exactly.
If you get rid of
it. That's right. That's right.
So, you know, maybe it's just a matter of how you're using the word ontology, that even if they're doing, I was saying Nagarjuna, even he was being phenomenological, although I hadn't really thought of him in that way before, in this sort of breakdown analysis, you know, sort of in the same way that Hume is in analyzing causality down into the constituent perceptions and things like that.
Right, right.
But that may be imposing the term phenomenology on that is a little arbitrary, that, you know, that was just philosophy to them.
Yeah, but you're helping me to see there is this conflict that we keep coming back to. I think it goes like this. There was this sort of, you know, back in the day, I don't know much about this, but Russell and even the positivists thought that even science was based upon appearances, sense data, right? So that all of science actually starts with phenomenological data, givens of mm-hmm. various sorts, and is built up out of it. Now, if you have that view of even science, then you're going to say, well, pretty much everything is beholden to the phenomenology. And I think there's a sense in which that's plausible. But I do think that there's a big difference between, especially now that we're into, I mean, Wilfred Sellers, when he defines the scientific image, he says, what makes the scientific image the scientific image is that it ontologically commits itself to unobservable, or what he calls imperceptibles, to explain the phenomenon. Now, that mm-hmm. does seem to me to be a move where you say, well, there's nothing in experience like bosons or fermions. But our best theories find that they can explain the way the appearances seem, plus a lot of other things, by positing the existence of these things and actually being ontologically committed to it. So that back in when I was in graduate school, 20 years before you guys, we all read Quine, and we all learned, of course, who do you look for the best practices of ontological commitments? You look to scientists who weren't positing things that were in ordinary experience at all. They were trumping ordinary experience with very, very complicated postulations of other entities. But you're getting at something like Mark Sideritz has a review of my book, and he thinks that one mistake I make, this will go along with your phenomenological reading of the tradition, he thinks one mistake I make is that I say the first piece of Buddhist metaphysical wisdom is that everything is impermanent. And because everything is impermanent, I am impermanent too. I sort of do say it that way sometimes. I didn't mean to say that it was a logical consequence. So notice, if you do it that way, you say, well, what's your evidence for everything being impermanent? It could either be phenomenological, or you could say something like, oh, the scientists say this and I believe them. So you could imagine that you'd have different sources for this.
Well, it's either inductive or it's... you're grasping an essence, if that's the kind of phenomenology you're doing.
Yeah, right. A big part of our tradition would involve saying it's inductive, again, it's abduction, it's inference to the best explanation, given the way human history has gone. Of course, it's based on experience, but it goes well beyond our experience in a Humean sense to say that everything is constantly changing. Sideritz thinks that no, the Buddhist insight does come from phenomenology and has to do with focusing first and foremost on my own experience, in which case the first truth is that I am not a permanent thing. And then secondly, that nothing else is either. That would be a different logical way of putting it. And Sideritz knows these texts much better than I do, so I'm willing to grant him that that's the way they did it. And if that's the way they did it, then the phenomenological within the tradition did have priority. I just think, since one of my big concerns is whether or not Buddhism is the kind of metaphysical and ethical theory that Westerners could find appealing or should find appealing, I think overall, starting with this sort of Heraclitean idea that everything's in flux, it might get more fans on board right at the get-go. There's more philosophers, I think, who could see, you might say, even Cartesians, right, who believe that there's a immutable essence that is me, there's really an Atman or a self, mm-hmm. might be prepared to acknowledge that the rest of the world is in flux. So that may be one reason why I start there. But I think the trouble with having any view about what exactly Buddhism says is that there are only Buddhisms, there's no Buddhism. So it's tricky.
Sure. Well, and that works well with your overall project that we're just trying to find among the major beliefs, things that will work well with the modern zeitgeist or will be acceptable given naturalistic preconceptions.
Right.
We posted that we're going to do this interview on our blog and folks chimed in and we got some comments, as I expected, that something about this is it's missing the heart of Buddhism.
Yeah, or right.
Just the fact that you really emphasize that most actual Buddhists don't meditate.
Right.
Where that's a central thing among, certainly if you listen to Buddhist podcasts in the U.S., a lot of it is talking about different meditation techniques and different, that's just part of the culture of how it works here, that people are trying to take things from the lives of monks, essentially from really high level. But what the basis of Buddhism is as a huge, massive religion is not this esoteric stuff that only some monks do. And you say even most monks don't meditate, right?
Right. That's right.
I guess depending on the tradition.
It's pretty much. So maybe it's a good time to backtrack a little bit. So one of the reasons I was really fascinated by the Buddhist case was I always knew, since I grew up in a conventionally religious family, surrounded by people who were conventionally religious, that is, almost everybody I knew was either Roman Catholic or Jewish. But I was aware in college in the late 60s that Buddhists at least didn't believe in God as we conceived of a creator God. So I always thought that was interesting because most people, when I ask them, even to this day, if I ask students, what is the definition of religion? They will say that a religion has to do with a belief about creation and divinity. And of course, that's true of the Abrahamic traditions. But Buddhism is just an interesting case where they just aren't gripped by cosmological arguments of the existence of God. And you kind of like think, this is fascinating, right? Because in our tradition, from Aristotle to Aquinas, people just think, well, there's got to be an explanation for how this got here. And the best way to go is some kind of design, teleological or cosmological argument. But for reasons that I don't claim to completely understand, they get that positing of a God involves the question of how God got there, and that would involve a regress of gods. So even in the Buddhist traditions where they do talk about creator gods, he's usually like someone like the lowest, the poor orphan redheaded stepchild of a good god, because how could a god have created such a mess if he was really in charge?
More things Nietzsche would like.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. That's right. Exactly. But I always wondered, I thought, well, you know, what is this? I mean, here's a tradition which is not theistic or religious. It doesn't fit the mold of a normal religion. It's atheistic at one level, at least, despite the ghosts and spirits that are abundant and transmigrations of souls across multiple lifetimes. So this is interesting. And it obviously is already catching on among people in the West. Some people say it's the fastest growing religion in Australia, America, and England. I don't know if that's exactly true.
Faster than Jedi?
Yeah, exactly. Fascinating. So I was just curious about that because, you know, of course, again, we have this strand of thinking in the West. Even people who are, you know, it's the Dostoevskian moment. Even people who are skeptic about religion will sometimes wonder, and this is one way of reading Nietzsche too, if people really stop believing in God, then all hell will break loose, because minimally, motivationally, people need to believe in a system of divine reward and punishment or something like that to keep them under control. If there is no God, then everything is permitted. But here's a tradition which doesn't have a God, although it has something close to our system of reward and punishment in this sort of karmic justice system. So I was just curious about what Buddhism was like on the ground. So I traveled a lot in Asia and I read a lot, but the answer is that Buddhists at big monasteries throughout India, there are these Tibetan monasteries, which are like Ohio states. They have like 40, 50,000 students. And according to George Dreyfus, who's a professor at Middlebury College now, he's a Swiss philosopher. He went right through the Geshe training, which would be like a PhD. He says that the average monk meditates about 5 minutes a day in these big monasteries where they're called upon to meditate. Mostly they're playing soccer, they're yelling, they're debating, they're reciting texts and things like this. In Thailand, where I was, which is Thailand and Sri Lanka are the most Buddhist countries in the world, There's almost no meditation. There's a lot of people paying monks for merit, which is thought to be a way like indulgences were of paying to get a better afterlife. But it's basically the Zen tradition, which is very popular. Of course, in America, Zen is not the biggest Japanese Buddhism sect either in America or in Japan. But of course, they have a long seating tradition, a tradition of sitting and meditating. And that's captured the interest of Americans. But a lot of Americans think that the essence of Buddhism is meditation. And it just isn't true in Buddhist countries. But people get very upset with me.
What seems to go with that is, you know, if you emphasize meditation and attaining this enlightenment experience, is to say that the core of the religion is this very esoteric knowledge that cannot be put into words. We had a whole Taoism episode.
And yeah.
Again, a lot of the take on nirvana is this is something that cannot be communicated. It's a long journey. Whereas the parts that you seem to want to take out of Buddhism and say would go well with the West are phenomenological analyses that you two, without really even maybe a lot of effort, can confirm. So the take about impermanence, just consider any of your experience and the fact that everyone around you dies and all that kind of, you know, that's not particularly controversial. The ontological status of that can be put into question, but, and likewise, no self.
Right.
I would again bring back the Sartrean analysis here that we have. He makes a distinguish between consciousness, which is essentially like the Heraclitean flux. It has no, you know, it's the Hume version of self. It's just this focus of attention on this, now on this, now on that. And there's really nothing that brings it together as a whole other than, you know, these, go read Hume and Locke the answer to that. But then at the same time, Sartre analysis accepts that we do have a self as a built character, as an object. It's not me exactly.
Yeah, all right.
I can't say that I am a student or I am a whatever, and that is my essence, but it's something that we build over time, and it has something that's socially useful about it.
That's right.
So that all seems to exactly confirm. I hardly want to make Sartre sort of the standard bearer for the West, the mainstream West here, because he is kind of a freak, but still, you can get something like the Buddhist insight completely independently of the Buddhist tradition.
Yeah, right. In fact, what you're helping me see tonight is, so you might say, okay, this is again, and as you pointed out, I get this from James, right? The Jamesian phenomenology is like the Sartrean one, it sounds like, will give you impermanence of the self. Nonetheless, you'll be able to use the conventional language to identify yourself, but you'll be identifying something like a stream of experience with appropriative memory that's projecting forward in time. It's very Dasein-ish. And actually, James, by the way, had read Husserl. So he knew Husserl. He certainly had read Bergson too, and he read Brentano. So one idea that I have, and so you said two things just then. One is that there is a strain of thinking in both Taoism and actually I would also say in Zen Buddhism and also other kinds of Japanese Buddhism. There's a form
Chan
of Buddhism,
Buddhism.
Yeah, Pure Land Buddhism, for example, that are much less cognitive. What I mean by cognitive is just something like they will frequently gesture in the direction of a kind of knowledge that cannot be put into words, the sort of ineffability thesis. And this is why Zen is very popular among intellectuals, but it comes with the maneuver of saying to someone like me, look at, we don't develop, as Tibetan Buddhists do and as some earlier Theravadan Buddhists do, a philosophical theory that can have what you would call philosophical theses in it, such as everything's impermanent, the self is one of the impermanent things, everything is related to everything else, everything is decomposable infinitely to other things. We don't actually put things that way. Those are things that you can gesture at. It's sort of like Wittgensteinian, right? We come up against the limits of language and we gesture in that direction. I definitely am looking for the kind of Buddhism that you can state for two reasons. One is that it gets phenomenological support in ways that you and I have been agreeing about. And the other thing is that it gets support actually from physics, from our best basic sciences. So when I was in college, when I was reading James, I was also reading Alfred North Whitehead. And in, I think it's 1918, Whitehead has this book called, he has a later impenetrable called Process and Reality, but his early book is called The Science in the Modern World. And there, Whitehead talks about an event or a process ontology, moving away from a thing ontology. And he thinks that modern physics is requiring us to start thinking in new ways, not any longer thinking in terms of substances. He has wonderful expressions, like he talks about the fallacy of misplaced concreteness is thinking that there actually are permanent things. And he just thinks that that's implausible. The example I like to use now with students is that apparently most scientists now think that glass is a slow-moving liquid. And that's kind of nice. So the thing about the cognitivist picture that you get in Buddhism, in Buddhist metaphysics, is it appeals to people who are doing sort of phenomenological study of themselves and the world around them, but it also will appeal to scientists who think that the structure of reality is much more wild and crazy than the world of things interacting in collisions in the way that maybe a Newtonian world might have it.
Oh, and this is Seth. I want to sort of get to the title of the book and kind of the motivation you had for writing it.
Yeah.
So Mark started to touch on it, looking for some sort of a wisdom tradition, I think is the term you use, to help somehow reconcile with naturalism, to give a kind of moral seriousness. I wondered if maybe you could sort of talk a little bit more about, and you're obviously motivated enough to go and write this book about, hey, maybe there's something in Buddhism that we can appropriate for this purpose, but why do we have to do it in the first place? And
right. Well, the way I was developing these ideas for a while was something like this, that among the agendas I've had are things like, if you're a naturalist, you've got two sort of problems. You're actually not going to have much of a problem doing, you might say, metaphysics. In at least one sense, you're going to say that the way the world is the way that our best sciences tell us it is. You still got two big problems. One is doing epistemology naturalistically and doing ethics naturalistically. There are supernaturalistic alternatives to both. You could decide that the best ways to gain knowledge will be to go to supernatural sources. But if you're like me and you don't believe there are supernatural sources, then you've got a problem. What are the best ways to gain knowledge? And their empiricist epistemological techniques look like the most plausible. The other thing you're going to have a problem with is, what are the sources for saying what is good or bad, right or wrong, what leads to flourishing and fulfillment, what will lead to a meaningful life, and so on. You could decide in both these cases. So Jagwon Kim and Hilary Putnam both responded to Quine's program of naturalistic epistemology by saying, look, at naturalizing epistemology is, I think Kim called it, epistemological suicide. It completely does away with the whole project of epistemology, because really there's nothing to say except to describe the practices that we're using. This is a way of describing Quine's project. It's sort of saying Quine is just Hume updated, and really all you can say if you're a Humean is that these are the practices we use, and so far they've been working out pretty well, we think, but we can't ultimately justify the techniques that we use to gain knowledge. Now, I feel like I have to bite the bullet on that and say that's right, but we have made progress in epistemology. We have been able to do things like starting with something like a Humean straight rule of induction. starting with something like the equipment of basic logic, we now have principles of statistics and probability theory. We know to watch out for things like fallacies of the small sample and unrepresentative samples. People have all kinds of statistical techniques that we, that is the community of inquirers, have come to believe produce chances to get what we really want, which is knowledge. On the ethics side, same problem. You could just say something like, well, there just are these practices that humans have, and there's really nothing deep to say once you go naturalistic about better and worse ways of living, more or less worthwhile ways of being in the world, more or less purposeful and meaningful ways of existing. I love to go back to Aristotle and hear Aristotle, who's a pre-Christian thinker. And he looks like he's able to say that there is this impulse that humans have to seek eudaimonia. Until about when I was in graduate school, we used to translate that until about 1975, I think, as happiness. And I think it was John Cooper who came along and said, eudaimonia should not be translated as happiness. It should be translated as fulfillment or flourishing. And one of the reasons is that Aristotle says you can't tell whether a person is eudaimon until you see how the grandchildren turn out. That is, long after the person's dead, there's things going on that reflect on the quality of his or her life. So these are kind of secular insights that I've been wondering for a long time. I mean, can you say normative things about what produces good lives versus bad lives for persons without propping it up with supernaturalistic information, as it were? So one of the reasons I like to look to Buddhism, it does seem to me to be a tradition. Some people read it as very therapeutic. You start with a moral psychology, which says if you pay attention to experience, you see that a suffering is around every corner, and we would rather flourish or be happy than to be unhappy. And then the question is there any information that we've gleaned from past human history or from our current world about what conduces to happiness and what doesn't? So I think of the wisdom traditions as what I call the really hard problem. The really hard problem is figuring out how to say sensible things about meaning and purpose and goodness in a world that is to be explained ultimately by a naturalistic metaphysics. In my previous book, The Really Hard Problem, Meaning in a Material World, I call this eudaimonics, which I describe as sort of the descriptive / normative inquiry into the causes and conditions and constituents of human flourishing. And you can see why I thought that Buddhism was good at this, because going back to that Abhidhamma, they were into saying, here are some states of mind that are wholesome, here are some states of mind that are unwholesome. And then it looked to me as if the arguments for why they're wholesome and unwholesome are not purely phenomenological. They have to do about what, over the long run of the course of a human life, possibly the life of a human culture, conduces to what some people call well-being. That was sort of the way of entry.
I like that in that discussion, it's pretty evident, if folks were still thinking that naturalism means materialism, which means reductionism. In other words, if I'm going to have moral language at all, I have to be able to somehow reduce that to language about what's going on in the brain. And just the fact that you have a view of virtue, say, that is not necessarily strictly an internalist one. It's not necessarily just these particular psychological states being manifestations of a disposition that is virtue, that really, if you're going to talk about virtue, you might have to talk about not just the particular attitude that someone has analyzing that person taken out of their environment, but analyzing the whole situation. If you're talking about, it's not just you, it's your relationship to the world. It's things that are not just in the head that are in the world too.
Exactly. Yeah. So whereas my view about consciousness is at least the part of experience that we call the conscious experience, that's definitely in the head. But I mean, things like character and virtue and these kind of complicated things, these are ways of being in the world. I mean, here I go, if I knew Heidegger better, I would say, it sounds just right to say something like a virtue is a way of being in the world as a being in time. It's spread out all over the place. Yeah, so I'm a fan of virtue ethics in the sense that I think that almost all the best theories, what Seth was, the wisdom traditions, they all try to think about what sort of internal psychological equipment does a person need to fare well over the course of a human life. And again, possibly to make contributions. And this is where I see the Buddhist idea of causation. The Buddhist skeptics or agnostics, and there are plenty out there, atheists, they call themselves, some of them, will say things, of course there's not any real afterlife. It's a metaphor for the fact that you leave effects. And a human is a kind of creature that cares about the kind of effects he or she leaves. Like when you're yelling at your kids, you really are caring about their well-being. Not 100%, because we're not that perfect, right? We're caring about our well-being too. But the point is, each generation is charged with producing good effects for other generations. And I mean, one could say, well, I just don't care about that, and I'm not sure what the response is to make. But that's an old philosophical problem across all traditions, what to say to the amoralist or the immoralist. But I think Buddhism has a lot of, again, wisdom about what, given the kind of creature we are, produces well-being. And some of these are just empirical generalizations.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that was brought to my mind as I was reading your book was, we had recently done an episode on the theory of moral sentiments from Adam Smith and Hume's version of that. And there's a very similar strategy, if you will, where with Buddhism, you're starting with compassion as a response to suffering, that Adam Smith talks about, as he calls it, sympathy.
Right.
Being sort of the foundation for this moral sentiment, which then grounds his system of ethics or system of morality. Now, Smith ultimately has to make an appeal to God and talk about God putting that sentiment in us. And Hume does not, I think, explicitly make that move. But
right.
I was wondering if you had any thoughts about, it seems to me that that would be another strategy to take that would be compatible with naturalism, or at least we could try to make it compatible with naturalism.
I totally agree. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Hume's theory. And Smith and Hume, in terms of sympathy and compassion, of course, you see in Hume the famous passage where he's responding to Hobbes, and he says, how people will act depends on the ecology. And he gives the example, he says, suppose we're in Shangri-La, where the weather is so commodious, there's no need of clothing. At cocktail hour, the pina coladas fall into your glass from the coconuts above. Everything is there, abundant. The lobsters come in and boil themselves in pots at dinner time. He says, in such a situation of profuse abundance, benevolence will increase tenfold, and the cautious, jealous virtue of justice will never be thought of. For why make something mine when there's plenty to go around, etc.? So it's pretty clear that Hume and Smith are in the school of thought that sympathy or compassion are innate, you might say. And you talked to Patty Churchland recently. Now, here's the difference, right? When Hume and Adam Smith wrote, it was not 1859. 1859, everything changes because we have Darwinian explanations, like the way Pat Churchland gives about the differences between montane voles and prairie voles. So we now have a story where, at least if Smith invokes God to explain how we have this natural tendency, now we don't need God to explain the natural tendency. We have something else to explain it that's much more naturalistic. But I think you're right. I mean, this is one of the reasons I think Hume has been so rehabilitated recently as a important ethicist, and Smith too.
It wasn't that Smith was necessarily having to resort to God to explain causally why we have these sentiments. It could just be that we just have them or there's no explanation.
Right.
It's to say why these sentiments that we find ourselves, as a matter of fact, having actually match up with what is in fact good.
Good. Exactly. No, I see your point. Right.
So natural selection serves the same function.
Well, see, but it doesn't for reasons that are worrisome to naturalists. The key is exactly what was just said. Just because natural selection put it in there doesn't mean it's good. This is a problem, right? Because some people accuse, it's already come up, do all naturalists have to believe in reduction? Do all naturalists have to believe in some kind of flat-footed identification of anything which is fitness enhancing with being good? That would be a very disastrous result for naturalism, and I think it's pretty easy to avoid. So, for example, there's a distinction that evolutionary biologists make between things which were historical adaptations and things which are adaptive in contemporary contexts. So, for example, it might have been fine that if you come near my mate with a wink and a stare, I'm going to start running after you with sticks and stones. That might be a very, very good evolutionary strategy for me to gain reproductive success for me and for you to have to go off and find your mate elsewhere. And it might keep things very stable and no one gets killed, perhaps, in a situation where there's just sticks and stones. So maybe jealousy was adaptive at one point. In the modern world with weapons of all sorts, etc., it doesn't look like it's as adaptive. And these are complicated contextual questions. I don't see that a naturalist can't say interesting, complex causal judgments about what is best, mm-hmm. given the kind of environments we live in now, yeah, as opposed to what we used to live in.
And even if it's still adaptive, it doesn't mean that it's necessarily good, right? Because
exactly,
adaptation just is there to maximize reproductivity. And that's always in tension with the well-being of the organism, right?
Exactly, right. There's many other levels.
If I didn't have to go out and reproduce, I'd be much better off. I'm actually impelled to do dangerous things to maximize my reproductivity.
Right. Again, this is an area that the naturalist just has to face up to, because he has to be able to make qualitative judgments about the quality and worth of lives. I am, in general, bothered by the excessive enthusiasm for neuroscience in general in the culture right now, as if, you know, the brain holds all the secrets. I think now the brain is the most overrated organ that there is. It's as if social sciences didn't exist. I mean, it's as if, you know, we forgot about sociology and anthropology and social psychology. Sometimes I feel this way. When I was over in India, a bunch of good neuroscientists started to make claims about meditation and happiness that, frankly, were an opportunity for a philosopher to be helpful, because there was a lot of work starting in the 1970s on differences in brain activity with people who had positive moods versus people who had more depressive states of mind, as mm-hmm. measured sort of behaviorally and up to a point phenomenologically. So what started to happen is that there started to be, and I think this was hype. I mean, I have to admit, the Dalai Lama, not that he's the boss of Buddhism, he's very interested for political reasons and also because he believes in Buddhism, in having it have a very, very good reception in the West. And there was a French, we're talking about phenomenology, the meetings that the Dalai Lama has been having with scientists have to do with the fact that he himself is curious about science. But one of the first scientists he worked with was a fellow named Francisco Varela, who's an excellent neuroscientist, who was a leader of the French movement called neurophenomenology. And these were literally people who were trying to have people describe very simple perceptual experiences, like the shift of a Necker cube or the Wittgenstein duck rabbit, and then looking at what population mm-hmm. of neurons underlie this difference. So this really was an attempt to link the phenomenology with what goes on in the brain in these simple perceptual cases. And Sisko was at these meetings. He died soon after that. He was at these meetings where Richie Davidson, who runs this place called the Center for Effective Neuroscience at Wisconsin, was beginning to hatch the idea of doing studies on the brains of experienced meditators. He was looking sometimes to see whether or not meditators were more on the positive affect side of things. One of the findings is this: if a person describes himself as in a good mood, if you look at their frontal cortex, you'll generally see that there's more activity on the left side of their frontal cortex. If a person describes herself as low or yucky, you'll see that there's usually movement towards the right side. This was known in the 70s. There's no explanation, and this is correlational at this point. What happens is that it looked to most neuroscientists if affect was highly hereditable and that it was very stable. What was called your set point is very stable. So most people know that they're of a certain temperament. They don't vary too much. If a traumatic event occurs, like you get in a car accident and lose your legs, you'll go really rightward. But after about 6 weeks, there's a thing called adaptation. You bounce back to your set point. The same thing if you win the lottery. You move way leftward, and then after 6 weeks, you come back. So it is a very interesting question. Are there any practices that can move the set point? And this is what neuroscientists talk about under the phenomenon of neuroplasticity. So there started to be a lot of hype. I judged it to be excessive. And one of the points of the beginning parts of the book is that positive affect isn't necessarily the main thing that we're after in developing a theory of the good life anyway. And the way I put it sometimes is when we ask questions like, was Buddha happy? Was Confucius happy? Was Jesus happy? Was Socrates happy? Was Aristotle happy? Was Martin Luther King Jr. happy? It doesn't seem like the obviously the most important question. And that's where I come back to the question is about flourishing, fulfillment, or the meaning of life, not just whether you're in a good hedonic state. So I think that the Buddhists have been buying into this too readily, these simple measurements of hedonic states of your brain and thinking that's what matters to us. I don't think it matters.
Right. So you have the conceptual issue of exactly what happiness is, which rather than trying to come up with a set of necessary and sufficient conditions that everyone will agree to, you just say that, well, that let's describe what happiness is according to Buddhist doctrine. Let's describe what happiness is according to Aristotelian doctrine and, you know, hedonic happiness, and understand that we can figure out intuitively why one might call these happiness, but we just need to be clear about what goal is being shot for.
Exactly. That's right.
Correspondingly, then you came up with, given that connection between happiness and virtue, and at least both Aristotle and Buddhism, the same kind of take that let's just talk about what virtue is according to these traditions and what the putative connection between, if you are virtuous in either of these traditions, then as a rule, it will normally make you happy according to that same definition within that tradition. So trying to get Buddhism in dialogue with not only Aristotelianism, but Stoicism and Epicureanism and some others.
Right. The reason I like this word eudaimonia so much is that since most people don't know classical Greek, and actually the word is hardly ever used before Aristotle. It's kind of interesting. You know, the prefix eu means something like happy, like in euthanasia, good or happy. And daimon means spirit. And Plato used a different word. I forget the word, but it meant something like blessed by the gods. So it has something to do with spirit, but it doesn't have fixed determinate meaning for most Westerners. But it did seem to me plausible to think that most of the ethical theories which are contenders do usually put forward a theory about earthly happiness, about the kind of happiness that is suitable for humans. So what I do throughout the book is I use this word eudaimonia as the sort of a word that points to or gestures at a conception of flourishing as understood inside a certain tradition. So we could have eudaimonia Confucian, eudaimonia local hedonist club, eudaimonia 21st century liberal American, and so on and so forth. And one of the reasons for going into that at length is, as you say, it looks to me, at least if you were to look at Buddhism and Aristotelianism, they both do say that insofar as something like flourishing or happiness is possible for humans, and both these theories accept that in any given human life, you might not get it. Bad luck might strike you down. But insofar as it's possible, if you are virtuous by the lights of the theory, that's a normal and reliable condition of getting happiness. It's not sufficient. There might be dispositional or temperamental factors, but you won't be happy by the lights of the theory if you don't have virtue. So the example I use here, not to pick on Hugh Hefner, but you just might say it's entirely possible that his brain lights up very leftly because he gets up every morning with Playboy bunnies and he puts on a satin robe and he has a good hedonistic life. And so let's suppose that he's both dispositionally and his lifestyle is such that he's quite leftward in terms of affect. Well, that shows us that positive affect is not a reliable marker of having a certain set of values or virtues. There's nothing in Aristotelianism or in Stoicism or Epicureanism or Buddhism, for that matter, that would mark him as a eudaimon by the lights of those theory. There are theories, like a hedonistic theory, which would mark him as eudaimon by the light of that theory, but it isn't what we would traditionally call a virtue theory, I don't think.
Now, are we trying to rule out calling that happiness sort of by definition, that we're going to just set up a theory that says unless you have some sort of virtue, then you can't actually be happy? Or are you kind of just punting on that?
Yeah, no, I actually don't want to do that. I think that's why there's certainly a conception of a human life, which is the life, let's just call it the 21st century American hedonist conception, according to which he's happy by the lights of that theory. If he is happy, I should put it this way, depending on how we define happy. So my idea is just to always relativize it to a theory and then wonder, while you're looking at a bunch of different theories, are there any generalizations across different theories that are applicable? So no, I don't want to decide it definitionally at all. Here's two findings that I think are actually relatively interesting. Daniel Kahneman has a TED talk in which he says that the biggest flat line in the history of economics is the increase to experienced well-being once you make, I think it's 75,000, let's assume it's up to 100,000 even. Once you make $100,000 American for a family of four across the world, there's no real increase in measures of experienced well-being the more you make after that. From 100,000 to 100 million, there's almost no increase. There's a lot of increase between $10 and $100 and $100 and $1,000 and up to $10,000 and then to $50,000 and up to $100,000. But at $100,000, it flattens out. Now, if that's true, that means that whatever gains Hugh Hefner is getting in the quality of his life or his happiness is not actually from the money or the things that his money can bring him. He might be getting it, but from other things. So that's an interesting finding, because it looks like it might be a truth of eudaimonics that money doesn't bring you happiness after you have a certain amount.
Wouldn't that amount being where you don't have to work anymore?
Well, that's apparently, it's an interesting question. I mean, it doesn't look like...
It takes more than $100,000.
Well, that's certainly not true. No, but that's categorically not true. That what you need is enough money that you don't have to work. Just look at the number of people who are retired who go out and find other jobs to have.
Exactly.
People who don't work are often simply unhappy.
No, I think that's right. There's no finding that I know of, empirical finding, that people are happier when they're not working. Marx was probably right in the Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts of 1844. The best work is unalienated labor, and not too many of us can do that 100% of the time.
Yeah.
But the main point is that the truism that money doesn't buy happiness looks to be actually true. Another finding, which I think is kind of interesting, and this would be true across various measures of well-being, is that there's a subtraction effect that's kind of interesting. So when they do studies of people, the following is noticed. So if you study British people, they will claim to have fewer emotional episodes each day than, say, Brazilians, by a lot. Let's say your average Brazilian, if you ask him how many positive and negative experiences did you have today, might say 20, whereas a Brit will say 3. What's interesting is that their overall sense of their well-being is very accurately measured by subtracting the negative ones from the positive ones. So, for example, if the Brazilian has 11 good ones and 10 negative ones, then they're a plus one. If the Brit had 2 and 1, they're a plus one. And according to most of these psychologists who study these things, they turn out to experience their overall well-being about the same. That's an interesting finding. Now, how you arrange this in your life to have the number of positive hedonic episodes outnumber the negative ones is complicated. But one idea would be, well, if you can figure that out, then you're likely to have a sense of positive well-being. And again, positive well-being is not the same as living a happy life or living a meaningful life or living a purposeful life. And that's why I think we have to parse out the meanings of all these different things very, very carefully. And that's one thing that people who are doing brain imaging of trying to look at positive states of mind are not being very careful about.
You have this interesting comparison between Aristotelian virtue ethics and Buddhist virtue ethics at the end of the book. And one of the big differences is the absence of essentially the virtue of compassion from Aristotle and the presence of it in Buddhism. And in reading that and what little I know about Buddhism, it seems to me that would be the big one, that in the eudaimonic space of the two ways of understanding flourishing and the components of flourishing, that the one having a central location of the notion of compassion and the other would be one of the huge differences. And I was just wondering about whether you agreed with that. And I was also wondering if, is there places that that shows up in Aristotle or Western style virtue ethics or non-Aristotelian traditions, but nonetheless in the West, it's just a blind spot.
Right.
And maybe related to that is just what sort of the consequences of that for the notion of flourishing is in both cases. Is it that at the end of the day, both cases really understand what flourishing is in the same way? They have a different understanding of what the components are. So therefore, you might structure your life differently. You understand different virtues as being virtuous, and you optimize those in different ways. So you have a different kind of underlying theory of flourishing. But at the end of the day, you both flourish the same way.
Yeah, I guess I would need to say, if the theories are different, then you don't flourish the same way, because what constitutes your flourishing will be different. So the first part of the question is, compassion is definitely the first among the virtues for the Buddhist. There's no doubt about that. Understood as the powerful overriding desire to alleviate suffering in oneself and in others. Now, you could say, well, what's the justification for that in Buddhism? Some people will say that the justification for it being a virtue, for it being good, is that you'll feel better if you show compassion for yourself and other people. I take it that's just a psychological claim, right? It doesn't really say much more than you'll feel, you know, some people say, well, if you do charitable works, you'll be surprised. We even say that. You'll feel better about yourself. Maybe, maybe not. Some people would say that Aristotle has something like compassion, but it's not certainly the desire to alleviate suffering in all its forms, because he wasn't seeing a lot of suffering. We know that there were slaves and things like this. There is generosity in Aristotle.
Yeah, but it's not, I mean, that's clearly not the same thing.
It's not the same thing. And certainly magnanimity, being able to give money like Bill Gates, is not that. And greatness of soul, knowing that you're a super duper guy and feeling it. So I think you're right that it's not there. But you might say what Aristotle still has, possibly, is the kind of Greek honor sort of ethic where, you know, there are just sometimes people who just have to suffer, whether it be in war. I mean, after all, he's the teacher of Alexander. It may just be that Aristotle just didn't really understand, either phenomenologically or in terms of its place in a human life, the role of something like compassion. So I think it's fair to say that when do you start to get compassion in the West? It looks to me like in Christianity, you start to see it, something like a virtue of charity, which in some ways, right, is certainly much more expansive than Aristotelian generosity. And you certainly seem to get it. It looks to me like Hume's benevolence is in some form, even though it's not attempting to be any kind of secular modeling of Christianity, is closely related to compassion. Of course, in utilitarianism, John Stuart Mill, after he derives the principle of utility, says, it's just like the golden rule of Jesus of Nazareth. And actually, Hobbes says the same thing in Leviathan. So somehow or other, it's getting into the West, but nothing like the strong form it has in Buddhism. The other thing that I would call attention to, about which I have more thoughts than that, is that so if compassion is big on the Buddhist list and not on the Aristotelian list, the thing that's missing from the Buddhist list is a conception of justice as fairness as a major virtue. And whether it's there in Aristotle or not is questionable, but it clearly becomes a dominant virtue in our tradition. And you just don't see it in Buddhist traditions. I've written some things since this book in which I'm more explicit about the fact that I think this is one reason for why there's never been a successful Buddhist political state. Never, I would argue. The countries which are Buddhist countries that are stable are not Buddhist at the level of government. So, for example, Thailand is a monarchy. Burma is a Soviet-style dictatorship, at least it was until last month. Maybe it still is. Tibet is a feudal theocracy. Bhutan is a racist monarchist state, the most Buddhist country in the world. So you almost never find a conception of leadership, political leadership, that embodies Buddhist virtues. It's kind of interesting. And, you know, my suspicion is it's just not equipped to be a the compassion. It's like a hypertrophy of compassion.
So it sounds like we can make evaluations of these theories and say point to certain deficiencies. I'm wondering how we do that, because it sounded like the primary way to do that is to judge the theories on their own lights as to whether they deliver on what they promise, let's say.
Right.
So how do we say that, let's say, a lack of emphasis on compassion is a deficiency in Aristotelianism, or a lack of emphasis on justice is a deficiency in Buddhism? One of the other major differences you point out between Aristotelianism and Buddhism is this more therapeutic element in Buddhism, and the fact that Aristotle was not as attentive to these destructive states of mind that have to be handled therapeutically.
Yeah, so I talk in the book about what I call the internalist predicament. It can look as if you're just stuck. You're going to be doing something like being ethnocentric if you start to say, well, I don't like the way this theory looks because it's too such and so. It's too compassionate, for example. Not everybody deserves compassion. And going back to some of the things we were talking about earlier, I mean, you might just say, well, you see this in American political discourse right at the moment. You might say, well, not everybody deserves compassion because they themselves should be taking more initiative to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. We have this kind of discourse, right, that it assumes a whole background metaphysical theory about agency, about effort, about freedom of the will, and it's hard to see how you let go of that. I think one of the advantages, what I would say, is of doing comparative philosophy, especially in a very cosmopolitan world like we live in right now, is that it isn't quite so much that you have to judge that the theory is deficient by its own lights, but you could do that. So like Alistair McIntyre in After Virtue and Whose Justice, Which Rationality used to use kind of an adaptation of Imre Lakatos's view on how you compare scientific research programs. And roughly the idea was that two scientific research programs, if they both solved all the problems, but one, the second theory solved all the problems that the first theory solved plus some new ones, these would be empirical problems, prediction problems or whatever, or technological problems, then the second theory is better than the first. That is not usually the situation in ethics, because the ethics determine the ecology and what goes down appropriately in the particular ecology. But I do think what one can do, like let's just take the example of Buddhist compassion. If you think that a moral theory ought to be uploadable from the individual level to the town level to the state level to the international affairs level, Buddhism looks deficient at that. It's not good at solving problems like that. That would just be based on the empirical evidence that I was just citing. You just don't see countries where the virtues of Buddhism for the individual or for the small community move up very successfully to solve problems of, like, that Plato and Aristotle were worried about. Now, someone might say, well, it wasn't intended for that. Say, fine, but we need a theory that does that too. So we could just have two theories. We'd have a political theory that's not Buddhist, or we could figure out ways to change and adapt Buddhism if we're living in Buddhist countries. And some Buddhists are trying to do this.
Here's maybe another practical example in evaluation of this compassion, that there's a recognition by both Aristotle and Plato, and then by the Buddhists, on the other hand, of the communicability of suffering.
Right.
Right? If you're around people who are a mess, it's going to rub off.
Yep.
It's really hard if you're a social worker or something to go home and not have that affect you. Certainly, Plato in the Republic, and I think Aristotle's solution to this is, for the most part, avoid those people, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Just, you need to flourish yourself. That's sort of what you were characterizing as ignoring compassion. The Christian alternative that is sort of more in the culture right now, that Nietzsche was then reacting to and trying to get us back to the Aristotle version, was, no, just you need to be like Jesus, this ever-flowing font of generosity. Mm-hmm. And Nietzsche's complaint is that that doesn't work. You try that and it will bring you dry.
That's right.
This is
right.
Whereas the Buddhist has an actual way, what Wes was saying about the therapeutic, I think applies here as well, has a way of dealing with that, that what you're training yourself in developing Buddhist compassion, this loving kindness, is not to make yourself into a perpetual martyr, but to gain a sense of relation to yourself that you can show compassion without, say, getting yourself wrapped up in the problems of others and suffering along with them, that you've already sort of taken this attitude toward your own suffering that will immunize you to that sort of infection so you can still go out and help.
Exactly. That's right.
And that seems deeply related to the ontologies in the two different cases. If you understand, you know, a kind of single-pointed, one ultimate being ontology that's sort of roughly Aristotelian, then it sort of goes all the way down and you end up with a kind of nihilistic point of view, I think, in this respect. You get wrung dry. Whereas if you have this more, you're part of the middle of everything, then it makes it dealing with the tribulations of compassion probably a little bit easier to deal with.
Not that the Buddhist couldn't be self-deceiving in that's the same way that the Christian could be.
I'm not saying that they're singular relations in one. I'm just saying that the ontologies seem to go with them. The ontology underlying the Buddhist point of view that was outlined in Owen's book seems to resonate with compassion as a virtue. But an ontology that would be justice-oriented would be more about sort of what's the one thing that matters? And so it'd be one thing ontology.
This is why I say at the beginning of our conversation tonight, I was resisting putting too much weight on the role of phenomenology in the construction of Buddhism or actually any other moral theory, at least phenomenology understood one way, because I think there is all this other work that's being done by metaphysical views, which are maybe not, in the Buddhist case or in our own cases, very much made plausible by the lights of our phenomenology. They're just kind of long, complicated, theoretical trajectories that have developed their own kind of very complicated metaphysics, which we're asked to get on board with, and nothing less than the meaning of our life sometimes depends upon our being willing to get on board with seeing the world in a certain way. And that's back to the ways in which the virtues and the view of the world then can be suited for each other in ways that are complicatedly circular and self-confirming. One thing we might say, because what you guys are just bringing up now is this. There's the Nathaniel West book, Miss Lonely Hearts, the guy who's like an Ann Landers, and he's way too overly absorbed in the problems of other people. He just can't get out of them. And we do think of that as a deep deficiency. And you're right that Buddhists have all these ways of detaching from the compassion giving. And actually, there was for a long time, before there were bodhisattvas in the modern period, there were people called arhats, these were the early Theravadin, and there still are monks who do this, mm-hmm. they just go off and contemplate on compassion. They don't do anything about it. So there's a kind of a tradition, just like in our monastic traditions, where there's a lot of very private focus on development of these virtues, but not the enactment of them in the world. In the West, by the way, there is this really neat movement called socially engaged Buddhism. Thich Nhat Hanh, who's mostly in France, is a big proponent of this. But a lot of Western Buddhists think that this is the way to go, and it has to do with that I suffer if other people around me suffer. And that's not something that is automatically seen and easily seen by Westerners, possibly for reasons that have to do with our larger background philosophical theories.
You know, I want to make sure we make the point before we let you go, since Dylan was just talking about the connection between the ontology of Buddhism and the ethics. I thought one of the biggest critiques of Buddhism in your book here was that there's supposed to be a simplistic story here between once you recognize that everything is fleeting, that everything's a flux, that myself is a flux, then that is supposed to lead to compassion, because you're no longer grasping at things that, oh, there's really no ego, so why am I trying to hold all these things to me, to my ego? Instead, I can recognize the suffering that's right there in front of me, and I can be compassionate to that instead of clinging inside my little shell here. But as you point out, there's nothing that necessitates from the no-self doctrine. There's nothing that comes straight out of that to give you compassion.
Right.
Right. I have a quote here where you're talking about Derek Parfit and his modern theory of the modern version of Hume's theory that the self is an illusion, essentially. Parfit himself does entertain the prospect that the recognition of my mutability and finitude, the fact that I'm a selfless person or something in the vicinity of a selfless person, might make me feel depressed, more indifferent to myself and others than I was when I was under the illusion that I was more than that. Or go with the flow hedonism. You raise a few other things in your conclusion, and here seems to be the relationship between these two is not clear, that it seems like getting the I should be compassionate has to come from a different point in the phenomenology, say, or somewhere else, some other intuition.
That's right.
Right. Than just this metaphysical theory about the self.
Right. That is a major theme of the book that I tried to work out. Someone could just come in with the other part of Hume and just say, look, it's always the case that no ought follows from any is, and metaphysics gives us is-is, and ethics gives us oughts, and you're just not going to get from one to the other. But I was kind of bothered by the fact that enough Buddhist friends, acquaintances, and texts had told me or made me believe that within Buddhism, there was this logical necessitation from really understanding or really grasping no self, that I am an ephemeral thing, and being compassionate. And furthermore, as you've just pointed out, Derek Parfit says the same thing, and he quotes, actually, in a footnote, he talks about a Buddhist text which makes the same point. And so Parfit's idea is that if I go in the direction of a Humean view of the self, which, as you pointed out, is very similar, up to a point, to this deconstructed Buddhist view of the self, the way Parfit puts it, that gives me reason to be less concerned about my own future and more concerned about, say, the people I'm with now who are not me. Now, I kind of get what Parfit means there. He means something like this, that myself in 20 years is in some ways not me. I'm much more distant from myself in 20 years than I am from you, my next door neighbor, right now. I think that's the kind of empirical insight. Now, that insight is supposed to motivate me to want to be concerned about my neighbor right now, and maybe less concerned about my future. So Parfit has the same sort of problem. But as I read the Buddhist tradition, I think you could take the doctrine of no self in the direction of thinking, okay, if I'm not a permanent self, then at least what I'm going to go for is good experiences for the closest continuer to myself in the next minute, and the same thing for the next minute after that. And the closest continuer seems to be psychologically and physiologically connected experientially to the guy that I am now. At least my previous experience makes me think that. And so why not go for all the gusto I can get from here on out? And that could involve my being not attentive to the needs of other people, except for the ones who I directly love, care about, etc. I've been trying to think about it, though, in the sort of Humean way, to think that no metaphysical theory, because it will be a descriptive theory about the way reality works, will in and of itself logically necessitate a certain normative way. It might, though, have some motivational bearing on you wanting to be a certain way. But that's the closest I could come to see how Buddhist metaphysics in any way warrants an ethics of maximal compassion.
We usually sort of go around and do a little closings. Who wants to start?
Well, I'll start and I'll just say thanks, Owen, for coming on. Really appreciated it. I know it took a little while to coordinate schedules. It sounds like you're a world traveling guy this past holiday season. I was the one who originally bought the book and read it and suggested to the guys that we talk about it. I think your approach is really interesting. You make the subject matter very approachable, and you do so from within a philosophical context that is probably going to be more familiar to most of us. We've had some, when we did our Nargujjana episode and in conversations in the past about Eastern philosophy, you know, we've sort of all acknowledged a lack of experience or reading in that area. And sometimes we struggle to grasp some of the essential concepts that we see in these Eastern philosophies or wisdom traditions and make sense of them in our own. And I think you do a good job of bringing the two together. And of the group, I'm probably the one who's most interested in ethics and the one who's most interested in answering the questions of how we should be treating each other on a day-to-day basis. I'm inspired that you're trying to address that question with an eye towards what I consider to be a somewhat pernicious naturalism and a kind of zeitgeist that prioritizes scientific inquiry over everything else, and I think in some way leaves questions of meaning and value and virtue off to the side. So kudos, and thanks again for spending some time with us this evening.
Thank you very much.
I really enjoyed reading the book, and it was great to hear more from you tonight. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, likewise. I really enjoyed the book, and thank you.
I wouldn't mind closing with to sort of answer my own question, and because I'm anticipating the response from actual Buddhists if we didn't scare them off with the many minutes of talking about non-Buddhists at the beginning. So maybe we won't get this critique, but I can very much see the link between the metaphysical and the ethical. I can see someone saying it's not a matter of logical deduction, approaching this all as here is a series of things that Buddhists believe and what can we conclude from them in the manner of Western philosophy is fundamentally off base. That what this is when you meditate on no self, say, then you will find phenomenologically that you are compassionate, that this will just come around. And I guess my response to that is what I was saying about phenomenology at the beginning of this, is that I think the phenomenology will be inevitably tainted by theory. Really, you're not reporting directly on experience. That if you buy into Buddhist doctrine, and so you learn on the first day that you're supposed to be compassionate and you're supposed to think of no self, then as you go further into the meditation, of course, that will confirm the thing that you wanted to go in believing in the first place. So I still think that the kind of strictly logical analysis that you are doing, not only is it justified by the fact, as you were saying, that most people don't meditate and don't have this sort of elite knowledge that the gurus would have, and yet they still come to the same. If we're going to communicate these things, of course, yes, talking in this way, talking at all is going to be useful. And I guess the proceeding was just to sort of say that ultimately that any sort of inward exploration that we're going to take is going to be influenced in a great deal by what the results of this talking have already been.
Right. Well, that's interesting because I thought, Mark, you were been a fan since the very beginning of the conversation tonight of thinking of phenomenology as being able to deliver certain kind of pure knowledge. So I quite agree with what you just said. In my experience, by the way, so first of all, let me just say I really enjoyed this and I appreciate you guys taking so much time to talk about the project. There's reason to worry about pernicious naturalism. There is a kind of scientism afoot in the culture that I think is a serious problem. And I hope that the book is part, and my other work is part of a project of showing that there's a kind of a sensible naturalism that is not reductive and that is open to facing up to, as I said earlier, these problems about normativity in general. We engage in normative discussion all the time across aesthetic experience, cinematic experience, architectural experience, engineering experience. I mean, it's ubiquitous in human life. And if we're doing something which makes no sense, this is a serious problem. And if naturalism can't explain it or make room for it, then there's a real problem. The other thing I want to say is that I appreciate the comment about how little we all know. And this is certainly true of me, too. You know, we all grow up inside traditions. Increasingly, modern kids, I think, grow up in, especially in cities like London and New York, say, are growing up in cosmopolitan cultures. And there's more and more being done to teach about Eastern traditions and doing comparative philosophy. But it's interesting to me, I'm going to be writing something in the next month or two, it's overdue, for the New York Times Opinionator about the worth of comparative philosophy. But it's very interesting that there are very few PhD programs in the United States who have strengths in Chinese or Indian philosophy. Outside of Hawaii, there aren't too many places at all. I think that's a problem because mutual understanding of people that we actually now just don't, you know, we confront each other. We are in the midst of people from all different cultures with different ethical and metaphysical theories in their blood and bones. So I appreciate the acknowledgments of the worth of doing that. And then as far as the question about what Buddhists will say about what happens when they meditate, in my experience, and this goes back to some of the earlier discussions of Merleau-Ponty and Husserl, some Buddhists do act as if they experience, for example, their non-physical self in meditation. And they actually take this as evidence that there is a non-physical self. And so one of the things that was very helpful in the discussion for me tonight was going back and forth from sort of this question about whether or not phenomenology, whether it be done in the East or West, should be taken as something which is authoritative about more than experience. Of course, there are issues we didn't go into tonight about whether or not we're even good about describing our own experiences, which is a whole other topic, right, which is of interest to many people in cognitive science now. But I think this whole, what just was coming up now, Mark, what you were bringing up is the whole thing about the theory-ladenness of experience. The fact that Buddhists have Buddhist phenomenology when they meditate or engage in the sort of mental practices that they advocate, it's not clear what that shows other than that these normative systems are set up in certain ways to produce what they claim is there. And to what extent that's a matter of discovery or to what extent it's a matter of creation is a really interesting and important problem. But my experience of Buddhists might be what we're getting at the end is that they just might say, look, logical necessitation is a fetish of Western philosophers. And that's why you guys can get all fussed up and bent out of shape about the inability to justify induction or deduction. And we don't have that concern. We just find that a good practical solution to the problem of living is to be maximally compassionate. It's not because it is logically necessitated by no self, but they mutually reinforce each other. That would be, I think, the plausible claim to make. So thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.
Good night to you.
Next time, we're going to continue our discussion of this book and hopefully delve a little bit deeper into some of the theses that he brings up in the book that we didn't have a chance to explore in this dialogue with him.
I want to thank folks that have contributed to the podcast. We suggest a $1 minimum donation for anybody that likes this. Some of our bigger dollar donators since last recording have come from Michael Fox, Ian Coxley, Marsha Valkyr, Adam Swartz, Anthony Pandolfi. We also have a bunch of things on the website for sale if you want to support us in some other way. We have a Facebook group. It is very active. We also have a Twitter feed you can follow us on. We have daily emails coming from the blog that anyone who is not foolish should surely be receiving. You could go on the iTunes store and give us a nice rating if you would like. And the most important thing you can do is just, come on, tell your friends, tell your family, spread the word about what we're doing here.
Isn't the most important thing for them to go read the books?
No.
Don't even worry about that. Donate first, read later.
Up in a river, boat, stay away. Circus float is your day.